These people are bound together by blood oaths, a secret religion, and the promise of an elite status within regional government and the world supergovernment. To put it in their own words, quote, if you are not one of us, you are nothing, end quote. Their religion is based upon the Kabbalah. They are not bound by any oath or allegiance save their own. They are loyal to no government or people save their own, and they are citizens of no country save their already in place secret world government.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. With me, Tony Gosling. Martial law in the UK. Is that possible post-Brexit, or is that just the latest line that's being taken by Project Fear? Plus, Ireland moves to implement boycott, divestment and sanctions of Israel. We go to the Israeli capital to hear from one of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers. And Malaysia, staying with Israel, is banned from hosting the Paralympics, accused of anti-Semitism. They don't want to give the Israelis visas. Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad explains why. Plus, carried over from last week, the Magnitsky Act, the US law the EU is about to pass. But is it just designed to stop Russian advocates speaking and doing business? Personal sanctions against anyone who supports Putin? Who was Sergei Magnitsky and his former boss, US financier Bill Browder? He, like some of the mafia's top oligarchs, fled Russia after Putin came to power, accused of fraud. But we start this week with former psychological warfare officer we've got on the line. That is Scott Bennett. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Scott. Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah, I got you, Tony. It's good to hear you. I was dancing to that cocktail music that you always have on your show. I find it so entertaining and refreshing.
Okay, so you were dancing there. Great to hear it. Anyway, look, is there any? What are the stories you'd like to bring to our attention this week?
Well, you know, there's so much, and we, of course, in America are dealing with the State of the Union address and President Trump and the Republicans and the Democrats and the wall, and then we've got caravans of South and Central Americans that are coming up into America, like the refugees from Libya into Europe. So we find ourselves in a very eerie, similar situation to what Europe has suffered. And this is manifesting in a political reality. And then, of course, Venezuela and the coup d'etat in Venezuela. And is this something the president and the American people want? It's a very dangerous situation to be toppling regimes, even if the guys are, you know, bad or you don't like them or they're leftists or they're
Look,
communists
Scott,
or socialists.
Scott, is it going to happen? Is it actually going to happen? Because it looks as if this has gone off at half cock. This a little bit like, actually, far less, in fact, than even the coup attempt in Turkey.
I think it is half cocked. I don't think it's going to go properly through, and that's what's really scary. Because when you are perceived to be incompetent, it goes five times as bad as if you never did it at all. So for the press, I was never a fan of doing this. I stand with Ron Paul and the libertarian conservatives that say, look, the world is the way it is. We should not be going in and toppling regimes, overthrowing people and cultures, because it is not about political economics. It's about so much more. The fabric of a country.
It's about, hang on, it's about oil, isn't it?
Well, that's what this is, but see, you can't just go in and confiscate oil and claim that everybody's going to be pacifist and let you do it. You could be starting a whole new Vietnam.
And Trump did say, Scott, Trump did say that he was going to not do these foreign adventures, and now it looks like something like that has happened. We've also got the whole situation with Trump pulling out of Syria, and now we hear that the Senate has voted to stay in Syria and Afghanistan. So it's sort of tug of war between Congress and the White House, isn't it?
Well, the Senate amendment that Mitch McConnell wrote, I don't think it's binding. In fact, I know it's not binding, but it is symbolically stupid for the Senate, a bunch of old geezers who never served in the military, most of them, to have the audacity or gall to tell young men and women that they have to serve and lose their lives and their legs and be horrendously wounded, potentially, by staying in a country that we've been party to destabilizing with Saudi Arabia and Israel and fomenting the mercenaries. It's a very stupid thing to do. The president has always got to tap into what do the American people want. It doesn't matter what the senators and the congressmen want. It matters what do the American people want. And notice, all of the Democrats voted against it. So all of the Democrats who are voting for president or running for president are standing against Mitch McConnell and the Republican call for America to maintain itself in Libya, in Afghanistan. The president needs to say, no, I promised the American people I would pull us out of these military adventures and endless wars, and that's precisely what I'm going to do. We're leaving Afghanistan. We're going to negotiate and try and make it a nice, easy, comfortable transition so we don't lose any political capital. And the same thing with Syria. I'm going to handle it with Putin and Assad and Iran to keep Turkey from slaughtering the Kurds, and at the same time tell Netanyahu and the Israelis stop going in and picking fights with Syria.
This is what Donald Trump does, isn't it? I mean, he's written this book, The Art of the Deal, which is basically about brinkmanship. It's about bullying, yeah, and threats, and then hopefully, yeah, coming to the table. And actually, apparently, he's now sitting down quite comfortably around the table with China, cutting what they hopes to be a much better trade deal than he would have otherwise got if he hadn't been so belligerent.
Right. Well, you know, Tony, that brings a very interesting analysis. I mean, you're aware of this. I'm aware of this. Many people are. It seems perhaps that the foreign leaders aren't as well schooled in this. He's thrown a bucket of cold water on them with his bravado and his aggression and his brinksmanship. And maybe that's a good thing because it's woken them up. It's sort of got them off balance. And that's his whole modus operandi, to get them off balance and then catch them before they think they're going to fall.
Okay, but what time does he actually throw them off balance, and that could actually lose the entire game? In other words, that you may completely, diplomatic relations may break down. You could even get a fight starting out.
That's right. That's the danger with Iran, and I've said that. I was over in Iran. I was at a conference, and I've spoken about this, and I've spoken to the Iranians in my presentations, and I've sent my material to the White House and Congress and different people that, look, the Iranians are a different people. They're Persians. They're thousands of years old. They've dealt with 40, 50 years of animosity between the U.S. and Iran, so they're not in a good mood anyway. And then you've got the Shah and Mossadegh being overthrown in the 50s, and the Shah coming in. They're not happy about that. So you're dealing with them in a way that they may not respond at all with positivity. They may be inclined to pick up their ball and go pout and have nothing to do with you. So in that case, you really lose the deal because all of your strategy and all of your tactics of being, bravado and bullying and pushing and loud and threatening, it doesn't have any effect. It's water off a duck's back. They're not going to pay any attention to you, and they're not going to listen to you. And then you've lost the opportunity. And I think that's what's happened with the JCPOA. Trump pulled us out, expecting the Iranians to come running to say, whoa, wait a minute.
This is the Iran nuclear deal.
Yes, the JCPOA, which I thought was a very silly thing to have pulled us out of, and I also think it was silly to plan our embassy.
So look, let's cut to the chase. What's the real motive behind pulling out of that? Because this is one of the only things that's keeping the Middle East together at the moment.
It was Adelson and the Israelis that backed Trump that gave him millions of dollars and said, you owe us. And he said, okay, fine, I'll pay off my debt. I'll move the embassy. And in a sense, it had already been done. Remember, the American Congress and the American presidents had all talked about doing this for a long, long time. Trump just jumped in and said, if everybody's talking about it, I'm going to go ahead and do it. And I don't think he thought it would have the negative blowback that it would, and it did. But it's also not been as bad as it could be. But it was done out of political reparations to Adelson and the wealthy AIPAC Jewish Israeli billionaires that were backing him.
Okay.
And his wife his daughter and Kushner, you know, they're all part of that operation. That's not beneficial to the president, mind you. Israel and all of this Zionist sort of assistance is not a favorable thing to the president, and especially the United States, given 9/11 and what we know about 9/11.
Okay,
and 9/11 is the greatest criminal act in the history of civilization. We always have to return to that as the cornerstone of this 19 years of destruction.
Now, I'm just looking at the whole thing of U.S.-Russian relations, because things are going downhill. Before he was elected, Donald Trump was in the middle of building Trump Tower in Moscow, getting very friendly with the Russians. And, you know, a cynical person like myself might even consider the proposition that one of the reasons that the Republican Party put him forward, because they wanted to stop that. And that's one of the reasons why Trump was put forward as a candidate, potentially. But the British have played quite an important role in trying to spike Trump's guns in various ways. And one of those is, of course, the dispute caused by the so-called poisoning of the former Russian agent Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, which I think there's been quite a lot of evidence has come out doubting the official government story, although the journalists themselves haven't really said a lot, you know, to criticise what the government has said. And I noticed that George Galloway's RT programme has got sanctioned by Ofcom, and Ofcom are considering sanctioning them, fining them, etc., for being critical of that whole Salisbury story. So I had a chat early this week with a fellow called Charles Shoebridge. Now, he's a former army officer. He's a former special branch officer. He knows quite a lot about these things. So I thought I'd get his take, and we can have a listen to that now, on
sure.
What exactly has been going on. Why is that the British broadcasting regulators are potentially sanctioning Russia today for broadcasting this programme, which was very critical of the British government narrative on the Skripal. So here's Charles Shoebridge now.
If the same Ofcom code is going to be applied in an even a uniform and a consistent manner, then indeed the BBC and others should have had those alternative voices and had them in sufficient numbers to inform the viewers or listeners in an unbiased way of alternative narratives and of criticisms and questions of that. Instead, the BBC and others, pretty much as in almost all aspects of foreign and security policy, merely acted as a mouthpiece to regurgitate or parrot what the UK authorities were telling them. And that's especially the case with much of the media that continually quoted unnamed sources, so-called security sources, and didn't question those sources' veracity, notwithstanding that they were often inconsistent and contradictory, even with what the same so-called security sources and so-called experts had said only days before. And so it's not so much the Ofcom code that's the problem here. I mean, the lawyers looking at this, if they come to look at this, may differ from what I'm saying. But when you look at the Ofcom code and you look at the way they've applied it in this case, they have, it seems to me, from just the first reading through, it's quite a long document, but nonetheless, I have read it through. It seems to me that the criticism of Ofcom isn't in the judgment they've come to in respect of this case, but that it absolutely is not that code of conduct, not applied consistently when it comes to mainstream broadcasters, as opposed to the programmes of people like George Galloway and RT and so on. The mainstream media's programmes almost invariably simply regurgitate uncritically the narrative that's propagated by the UK government when it comes to security and foreign policy issues, and that, of course, very much included Skripal.
So that's Charles Shoebridge. I'm also joined in the studio by, as we were in the last hour, by former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Cahill. I wonder what you make, Kevin, of this Ofcom code, because it seems that they're saying that it was the, Charles has pointed out there, that the George Galloway programme was biased against the government's account of the Skripal case, and there were too many people criticising it, so therefore it was biased. And yet the BBC's reporting has Not only is it often just quoting unnamed sources, but when those unnamed sources contradict themselves, the BBC journalists don't question them.
Nope. Let me bring you right up to speed here. Last year, I chaired the World Cybersecurity Conference, and one of the people, just over lunch, said Skripal was targeted because he was still selling Russian stuff. So this wasn't a revenge hit. This was a stop hit. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is, after the hit, we must have spent £50 million on an investigation. And after 3 months, what did we get? A dead woman. The investigation was so badly handled that people in Salisbury weren't warned to watch out. And have you seen the BBC report this? What you've just said about the BBC's reporting of anything serious at the moment is scandalous. As you say, they never ask questions. They never said, we've spent 50 million and what have we got? A dead woman.
I mean, at this point, I ought to say this show is being investigated also by the UK broadcasting regulator Ofcom. I can't go into detail. That's this show, the BCFM politics show. I can't go into detail except to say that their inquiry may conclude with this and other programmes being taken off the air, with fining of BCFM's charity management board, and may ultimately threaten BCFM's licence to broadcast. You're listening to one of the only radio programmes outside London that produces independent foreign news and comment, and one of the only investigative programmes in the country. So if we suddenly vanish from the airwaves, you know why. So this is Ofcom doing some intervention and potentially closing some TV programmes, fining stations. We already know there's been attempts to shut down Rush Today. But from you, Scott, what I'd like to get is a bit of a take on the British role in Russiagate, particularly through this guy, Pablo Miller, because Channel 4 News' Alex Thompson tweeted, I mean, this is at the time, this is nearly a year ago now, that there was a denotice on Pablo Miller. I noticed a fascinating little article, in fact. It's called Pablo Miller, the Spy Line. It's by a blogger called John Goss, and he explains that a bit about Pablo Miller's history. So I thought what I'd do is just have a little quick chat to John. I thought let's just get a little sort of quick, a bit of an idea of who is this guy. Maybe you could just tell us what you know, his involvement in the Skripal affair, Kevin, before we hear from John Goss.
No, who is this?
Do you know Scott?
Well, what I can say about the Skripal incident, we've talked with other Brits. Nicholas Collerstrom was on my show the other week about 9/11 and a lot of the information operations that we see going on. The British MI6 and MI5, the Brits in general, are not, of course, the Brits that we knew 30, 40, 50 years ago. I was born in Scotland, and my family hail from Scotland. But what we see today in Britain is a completely different entity, and it should alarm traditional British people who love freedom and honor and respect other countries and independence. We're seeing a creeping police state that the UK, the Canadians, the United States, Australia, the Five Eyes seem to be coordinating information operations against their own people using intimidation tactics, the Skripal poisoning, the White Helmet chemical attacks in Syria, blaming it on the Russians. They're seemingly picking Russia as the hydra that endlessly justifies their own military-industrial complex because they are guaranteed a job to cut off another head.
Okay, Scott, let's have a listen now to what John Goss had to say about who is this guy, Pablo Miller. He's a former military, British military and South African military, I believe, but he was the handler of Sergei Skripal, and we were told, the mainstream media in London were told by the military, don't report anything about him. And of course, you know, that's largely because he was quite a key person that people need to know about in order to understand the connections between, for example, this and the Litvinenko case. So let's have a listen to John Goss now, and I'll put a link up to his article about the spy line of Pablo Miller on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Pablo Miller is the man responsible for moving over here. not just Litvinenko, but also Sergei Skripal, two men who have allegedly been poisoned by the Russians. He was born in Johannesburg. He's got a kind of academic and a military background. He's obviously very good at Russian. Nearly everything you read about him, his Russian is very good. And on top of that, he was the first secretary of the embassy in Estonia. It was while he was there that he was recruiting various people, and among them was Litvinenko and Menko Zharko, who actually spilled the beans on him. And the reason that Zharko spilled the beans on Miller was because a man called Lugovoy had been accused by the British government of poisoning Litvinenko with polonium-210. Zharko didn't want to get involved in anything like that, so he went to the FSB, which is like the secret services, and he spilled the beans on Miller and who he was recruiting.
So that's John Goss there speaking to me earlier this week. Kevin, I mean, many people don't realise that it was Miller that recruited Litvinenko as well as Skripal to work for the British. And then, because of the death of Litvinenko, he was then dobbed in. I mean, it was only made public because people who'd been involved in that whole operation decided, well, you know, we didn't expect this guy to be killed.
No, as I said, the basic reporting... My position is really simple. I expect reporters to ask questions. None of the reporting, particularly by the BBC, was based on any serious questions. The poison is present in the United Kingdom at Porton Down. It was present in South Africa because we helped them get it. And nobody ever mentioned this. The Israelis have it. So a proper reporter is going to say, well, this... very strange poison turned up in Salisbury, and here is where it's found. The BBC didn't do that. But
why have we got any reason to doubt what we've been told about what happened last March in Salisbury?
Well, as I say, the comment was made to me that it wasn't a revenge operation, it was a stop operation, that Sergei Skripal was still selling Russian secrets and things, and that the Russians sent these two... But the proper perspective on the next step of the mystery is, if that's the case, why use a daft poison that's as dangerous as to the people using it as to the a person it's going to be used on? And then, why get yourself pictured, you know, tabloid style, all over Salisbury? But these questions need to be asked in a proper context where, you know, the people of the United Kingdom know who has... Novichok and these strange poisons.
Now, Scott, what's been the fallout in the United States over this whole Skripal business and Russiagate? Because this is Pablo Miller is tied to all of these, and also apparently to Christopher Steele as well, the author of the Trump election dossier.
Well, that's another piece of evidence that the Brits are up to their neck in undermining Trump and being pro-Hillary Clinton, being pro-military industrial complex, endless war. The British, certain parties in British politics and British military industrial complex are all about that. Christopher Steele confirms that the Skripal poisoning matter is not known much at all in the United States. Only those of us who pay attention and really study these things see and connect the dots, but it's very very passed over in many regards. But you can see the clear story is this, Tony. All of the intelligent people know Russia had nothing to do with the U.S. meddling in the U.S. election. That's all propaganda. That was engineered. That was falsified. The Russians have had nothing to do. The Iranians have had nothing to do with meddling in the U.S. election. This has been geared
So who did? Who did? I mean, there was a whole load of stuff exposed about what was going on in the Democratic Party as to whether Bernie Sanders or Hillary was going to get elected. So, I mean, I don't wonder if you'd agree with the thing we've discussed on here many times on this program, is that actually what happened is Trump is only president because Hillary Clinton stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders.
That's true. Bernie Sanders, she stole that, and people voted for him because they were afraid of her, and they did not want endless wars in the Middle East. They wanted the U.S. out. Trump was saying a lot of that rhetoric. He's very skilled and gifted when he is speaking to crowds, when his back's against the wall. He's not a politician. He's a brawler. He's a street fighter, and that's a refreshing personality compared to the plastic hair, bleach teeth, game show host politicians that are these effeminate weaklings that America has had. And you see them in the Senate and passing these asinine laws trying to say the U.S. should remain in Syria and Afghanistan. The American people don't want that, and they voted for the president to do the opposite, to get us out. And he's wise to do that. He will stay elected if he does that, but he will lose if he does not. And that's just the sign of the Israeli AIPAC influence over the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House and in the military-industrial complex, and sadly in the president's advisory circles.
Scott, you're pulling out of Afghanistan, you're pulling out of Syria, but there's the real danger of a war with Iran. So it's not Trump doing the peace trick. It looks more like Trump concentrating the military for a real war, a serious one with Iran.
Yeah, people have said that. I talked about that, and that's always a possibility.
That's a really good point, Kevin. What do you think of that? Because, I mean, you worked as a psychological warfare officer. I mean, surely, you know, some of your insight as part of that job could tell you how these things are prepared for in the public mind.
Well, that's a very good point, and it brings me back to something that just happened last week, and you probably know about this, Tony, was the arrest of Marzia Hashimi, the Press TV anchor woman, who is one of the most popular figures in Press TV. It's the Iranian news station. She's an American black woman who moved to Iran and married a husband there. She was over here in the United States. She was kidnapped, taken by the FBI to Washington, D.C., held in jail for a week, and was a witness to something, and that was it. She was never charged with crime. She was held as a witness, but she was held in shackles, and then they released her, and she's flown back to Iran, and she's just started to talk about what happened to her. But that, to me, was a provocation. That may have been an attempt to try and trigger an Iranian hostage situation like we had in 1979 all over again.
Okay.
Why was that done?
I think it would be interesting to get your take on how you think some side of sort of conflict between the US and Israel and Iran might unfold, Scott, because certainly as other things seem to be going on the back burner, that one isn't going away.
Well, Russia is the big spoiler, and that's perhaps why the British are focused on attacking Russia, and the US is being used to attack Iran. And you see that in so many of the neocon circles, from Pompeo to Bolton to everybody constantly banging the drum that Iran is an aggressor, when it is not. It really is not an aggressor. Saudi Arabia has been the aggressor in Yemen, in Syria. Israel has been the aggressor in Syria.
Well, the Israelis are saying that Assad is getting the Iranians into Syria in order to allow them to attack Israel. I mean, the Israelis have got to do something about that, surely.
Well, the Israelis they've been hell-bent on trying to remove Assad since, 4 or 5 years ago. That was how the whole thing started. And Assad, with Russia coming in and helping Assad survive, and many Americans went over there and saw that Assad was actually defending Christians, and he was not the boogeyman he was led to believe. Senator Dick Black did that. Tulsi Gabbard, who's running for the presidency, did that. And I made the same conclusion. The Israelis were the ones, and the Saudis were the ones, and the U.S. CIA were the ones who started this fight, and it failed. It was a coup d'etat that failed, so the Israelis have found themselves in a losing situation, and the Iranians were brought in by Assad, and the Russians were there to defend against Assad being taken out because they did not want another Saudi Arabian Wahhabi entity in the Middle East. They didn't want Turkey in there either.
Okay, look, sorry to interrupt you, but it's about time we heard from the Israelis. At the moment, he's the Israeli energy minister. He's part of the security cabinet in Israel, and it looks as if Netanyahu, in the run-up to the general election that is going to be happening at the end of March, beginning of April, because their coalition has broken down, he will become foreign minister for the Israelis very, very soon. So I thought it'd be interesting to see what his take is and what he's got to say about the whole situation with the Iranians.
U.S. sanctions might be more painful and more crippling than even international sanctions because of the secondary sanctions, because no company on the face of earth would like to mess with the United States or to miss the U.S. Market. Still, if you want to be sure that the effect will be tremendous, you have to assure two other things. First, you have to make it crystal clear to the Iranians that if they break to the bomb, or if they start attacking U.S. targets or U.S. allies in the Middle East suddenly, this is a war. The U.S. will use brute force against them.
Causes belly for military action.
Yeah. And the second, not less important, is what is going to happen with North Korea. Once North Korea will dismantle, this will have a tremendous effect on Iran, on the nuclear debate within Iran, because once it will be clear for Iranians that even North Korea gave in to U.S. pressure, people in Iran would say, okay, it will be stupid to proceed and to suffer for nothing.
Presumably, Scott, you noticed that your country has gone back to making small nuclear bombs, i.e. the nuclear hand grenade. I mean, what next?
Well, you know, I heard in that statement a future scenario of a false flag attack when the Israeli minister said, if the Iranians blow up U.S. commercial airplanes, that tells me one of the psyops that they may do is blow up a U.S. commercial airplane or make it look like one has been blown up by the Iranians. That's how a war could be triggered. It's a false flag Gulf of Tonkin incident. The Israelis are good at it. The British are good at it. And they may blow up some plane in Tel Aviv airport. They may blame it on the Iranians and the Syrians. But I wouldn't put it past them that they try and trigger a provocation and an attack on Iran. Israel is not going to rush into a war with Iran. They are going to provoke and try and blame the Iranians for some sort of an attack, false flag, that will then be used to justify American military attacks against Iran.
Prime Minister Netanyahu is very adamant that preventing Iranian encroachment in Syria is a red line. Now, if the world powers are unwilling or unable to compel Iran out of Syria, is Israel prepared to go it alone?
So far, I would say that the Iranian plan to use this brutal civil war in Syria in order to transform Syria into some kind of Iranian military garrison vis-a-vis Israel, so far, this did not succeed. Now we will insist and we will take all necessary measures, including, if necessary, brute force, the use of brute force, in order to prevent Iran from doing that.
So that was the voice you heard there of Yuval Steinitz. He's currently the Minister of Energy in Israel, about to be promoted to become foreign minister by Benjamin Netanyahu before his government runs out. They've got a general election coming up in a couple of months' time. But what do you reckon to what he's saying there, Scott?
I think they're preparing and hoping for a war conflict with Iran. That's always been Israel's, the Likud Zionist Party's agenda. I don't think it's going to work. I think the American people would stand against it. They're tired of 19 years of war.
Scott, surely it's not the Americans that would stop such a thing. It's more likely to be the Russians, isn't it?
Well, the Russians certainly would not allow it. The Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians have a defensive pact, if you will, even though it's not official. They realize that they cannot survive another country being toppled with regime change. They've seen what happened to Libya. They've seen what happened to Iraq and Afghanistan and the attempted Syria. They've seen Ukraine, and they know that this juggernaut of colonial Western UK, US, push is not going to stop unless it is blunted with a strong military alliance. And I think you're right. Russia would step in, and I think they've already made those sort of overtures in the Venezuelan situation. But these neocons and the Trump administration, I think, have been pushing President Trump in this direction, and he's been listening to them. Now, I think there's also a case to be made that he is doing a lot of this to make a deal to try and stabilize the situation with Korea, for example, and the Iranians and the Russians. I don't think there's any real chance of another war because too many people are aware that this has been all a psychological operation. It's been all false, and the U.S. have been damaged by it. That's what we're learning from the U.S. pullout from Afghanistan and Syria. The U.S. is not going to remain in these Middle Eastern countries. That's why I don't think they're consolidating power simply to go in and invade Iran.
Okay.
And Europe is another continent that suffered with all of these migrants flooding up into Europe.
Okay, in the background of a lot of this, and I'll bring Kevin in on this as well, the Irish have passed a BDS bill, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Bill, banning Israeli settlement goods. Israel summons the Irish ambassador. We hear, and I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, Israel summons the Irish ambassador over the BDS bill. We hear that Ireland has advanced this bill, which would prevent the sale of goods from Israel's illegal settlements. In the occupied West Bank, the lower house of the Irish Parliament, the Dáil, voted this week in favour of a bill which will ban the purchase of all goods and services from Israel West Bank settlements, considered illegal under international law. The bill was previously passed through the Parliament's upper house, the Senate, before proceeding to the lower house, receiving a 78-45 majority in favour. Al Jazeera reported it. I didn't see this reported in the British news, but Kevin, what do you make of what the Irish are up to?
No, I saw it. The Israelis have a general push on stopping anybody making any criticisms of Israel. The instant charge is you're anti-Zionist, and that's what they're doing to the Irish. The Irish have gone into a very strange stage of liberalisation, and there used to be a very big Jewish community in Dublin, and I don't think the tactics of the Israeli government are doing anything for Jewish people. The settlements are illegal.
I mean, in your experience, Jewish diaspora supportive of Netanyahu or not?
He has a lot of support, particularly here in Britain. I know a number of my Jewish friends are supporters of Netanyahu.
What do you make of it, Scott? The Irish are saying no goods here, thank you very much, from illegal settlements.
Well, I think the Irish are showing their temperament. They're a fighting people, they're a poetic people, and I find them very akin to the Scottish, and we share that warrior blood energy. And I agree with them. I stand with them. If these illegal settlements and apartheid actions by Israel and the Zionist elements are to be thwarted, it has to be through social and economic isolation and rejecting. That's what free peoples do. They're doing the same thing in America, mind
you. But why? Why? Because surely this sort of trade, free trade, should be allowed. You shouldn't be allowed to boycott trade like that.
Well, in the United States Constitution, you have a right to freedom of speech, and freedom of speech is manifested in how you spend your money and what you say, what you wear, who you associate with, and all of that is constitutional grounds that if you don't like a country or a regime or anything, you have a constitutional right to disassociate with it. That means not talking.
I mean, the boycott, of course, maybe Kevin, you can tell us a bit more about this, was very much an Irish invention, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Irish typically would have supported the Jewish people because of the war. There's counter-propaganda here in Britain over Ireland's position in the war. But my own parents were put on it, who have no Jewish connections, were put on a death list for sending food to Jewish refugees. The Irish have traditionally sided with the Palestinians as the underdog. And I think the Israeli government's push on the Irish is counterproductive.
Can you give us a bit of a history lesson, Kevin, though, about the Irish land wars? And because I think, you know, it was a Captain Boycott, I seem to remember, who was the originator of this whole concept.
Well, hopefully I have a book about Irish landowners coming out sometime soon. But the powerless, here it's one of the real problems. The Irish peasantry had absolutely nothing. They might as well have been slaves. The landlords were vile. So the only weapon they could find was to stop paying rent, but it did work.
Well, there's your potted history of Ireland and the boycotts, right? Also, this week we've heard that the Paralympics will not be going to Malaysia as they were going to be because the Prime Minister, President Dr. Mahathir Mohamad has said that he doesn't want any Israelis in his country. They don't have any diplomatic relations with Israel.
Dr. Emmas, he's known, is a sharp individual. And yes, his views would, in the modern context, would be classed
something
as anti-Semitic.
Like,
he doesn't criticize Israel, he criticizes Jewish people, and that's anti-Semitism. But he's a very sharp cookie. He's 93 years old, and he's prime minister. There won't be many people doing that. He will. The Israelis may find they have a real problem here. Mahathir is a toughie. He saw down the international financial community when they tried to beat up Malaysia. He saw them off, and Malaysia came out in much better state than it went in.
Israel is a criminal nation. It has been breaking international laws without anybody saying anything. So we have a right to voice our feeling and to have our own policies. Besides that, America doesn't allow people from five Muslim countries to go to America. Why is it that people don't complain? And many countries in Europe won't allow foreigners to come. This is normal. But we have a reason. These people are not seeking asylum. Takut, sakit, susah. Ini bukan orang susah. They come from a country which does not obey international laws. And we have to stand on our principles.
So that's the Malaysian Prime Minister saying that Israel does not take any notice of international law. They're standing on their principles. They're not allowing Israel to come to the Paralympics. So there will be no Paralympics in Malaysia.
If Scott is still there, the most important story I ever wrote as a journalist was to pinpoint the first intifada to the very hour it was going to happen. So I've got sensitivities here. But the Dr. M's position, as I say, is tough. But going back, the Israeli settlements are illegal in international law. That's a fact.
Scott, let's just get you and Kevin's view on the whole Russia role in this potential war between Israel and Iran, because they seem to be the key players. And I want to talk about the Magnitsky Act in a minute and the way that may be being used to try and take out people around the world who are giving a balanced view, the other side, if you want, of supporting a Russian position. What do you make of Russia's role, Scott?
Did the book Against Our Better Judgment, and that's a very good study in the illegality of the settlement, so I would concur with that. Russia's role in, specifically, as I've said before, Russia stepped into Syria to protect it from dissolving because it would have had very bad effects on the rest of Europe.
No, hang on. Surely, Scott, they stepped in because the Russians have got bases in Syria, Tartus, and they've got an air base, and that their military is in Syria.
Certainly, self-preservation. That's exactly why the U.S. went in Cuba in the 1960s when you had the Cuban Missile Crisis. So Russia did exactly what any nation would do to defend itself from potential long-term attacks, and they've seen the Saudi Arabian mercenary Wahhabi agenda. So Russia has stepped in as the stabilizer of the Middle East, I would say, Tony, because they have a lot more political cachet as a negotiating personality. Putin is a very good, low-key quiet statesman, and I think that has a resonance in all the leadership circles in the Middle East that President Trump does not have, that America does not have. America has lost all of that since the September 11th attacks and the subsequent juggernaut of military full-spectrum dominance conquest that we've allowed. And, of course, it's cloaked in the war on terror. It's cloaked on human rights. But everybody knows that's a lie. Everybody knows that fake. That's fake. And everybody knows the false flag attacks in 9/11 is going to come out. It is in the process of coming out because of the alternative media and shows like yours and others that talk about these things. But Russia has emerged as stabilizing the Middle East and stabilizing the world and allowing cultures and people and nations to have their sovereignty, whereas the West is perceived as disintegrating and dissolving their sovereignty if they are not subservient slaves or colonies of the U.S. dollar, UK, banking, international conglomerate. You know this well, Tony.
Okay.
So what's going to happen in the future? I think Russia is going to stop any military adventurism into Iran.
Just a quick point to emerge.
Russia has actually got quite a strong relationship with Israel. It's not often referred to. And I think it's a bit more nuanced. You know, Russia is playing a game, the West is playing a game, and the Israelis are playing a game. But the Russians have a strongish relationship behind the scenes with the Israelis.
Okay, so anyway, let's look into this Magnitsky Act now, because this is, there are various articles. Forbes magazine was saying the Magnitsky law is taking over the EU, just as Britain is supposedly leaving. And the Magnitsky Act is something which was passed in the United States, but is going through the European Parliament at the moment, and it allows the sanctioning of specific individuals. It's a bit like sanctioning countries, but you sanction individuals.
Boycott.
And it's all based on this chap, Sergei Magnitsky, who was an accountant for Bill Browder, hedge fund manager who was based in Moscow. He was accused of fraud and told to leave, and Magnitsky was jailed and he died in jail. But let's have a listen now to what Alex Craner has to say. He's written a couple of books about the case, about what he thinks is really going on with this whole Magnitsky case and the Magnitsky Act.
Something like close to 70% of all Russian economy ended up in the hands of these 11 handpicked oligarchs. And we found out about some of these agreements that existed because when Mikhail Khodorkovsky went to prison, it turned out that there was some kind of contract existing between himself and Jacob Rothschild's interests, or himself, where if Mikhail Khodorkovsky became incapacitated and unable to manage the Yukos oil companies and Menatep Bank and I don't know what else there was, that the interests would be transferred to an unnamed third party. And then the Times of London, in one of their articles at the time, disclosed that this party was essentially Jacob Rothschild. This article disappeared, but a similar article effectively disclosing the same story is, I think, still online on one of the BBC sites. So basically, as it turns out, in a lot of these privatization schemes, going back to robber barons of the United States in the early 20s of last century, it always turns out that the oligarchs, like J.P. Morgan, like John Rockefeller, that they actually owned a relatively small percentage of the wealth that they ostensibly owned, and that the actual interests behind them are the international financial cartel of families and individuals having control of the international financial cartel. And this was the case with the Russian oligarchs as well. So basically, to go back to the what was the point of the Magnitsky Act? When Putin came to power, he did not take the Western dictate anymore. And so there has been, I think, pretty much hundreds of investigations already from before Putin came to power, but they were killed. There have been hundreds of investigations of what happened to our assets. Where did they go? Who took them? How much did they pay for them? Who owns them now? And so forth. And so these investigations can do what they can do within the Russian system, but they cannot go beyond. So the Russian state investigators would then, the logical next step would be file suits in jurisdiction where these offshore companies are, in Cyprus, in Guernsey, in Jersey, in Cayman Islands, in London, in New York, and so forth. And, you know, when you file a lawsuit, when you start an investigation of this sort, then, you know, in Western jurisdiction, a lot of things start happening it's a mechanism. You hire lawyers, they start finding out documents, they start filing Freedom of Information Act, they start deposing the actors, the witnesses, and so forth, and a lot of what has happened comes out on record, black on white, that can be just made to disappear. You know, it becomes part of the public record forever. So my theory was that the whole purpose of the Magnitsky Act was to frustrate Russian investigations into who took their assets, because that's also their means of recovering their assets eventually, to establish that this was not a purchase in good faith, that this was not a fair economic value that was paid for them, and that therefore the whole process was under duress or whatever, and that to start to reverse them. So in order to make this impossible, in order to frustrate the Russians at every step, I think it is necessary for these financial interests that participated in the 1990s raid on Russia to create legal barriers for the Russian state to go after these assets. And this is what Magnitsky Act is exactly.
To chip in on your the people who financed Brexit, especially around the Tory things, this is knowledge I have from the Sunday Times, keep most of their assets in British tax havens. Getting Britain out of the European Union is a great way of protecting those tax havens.
Do you think the Russians will ever get the money back, the wealth back that was stolen by the oligarchs in the 1990s? I mean, was that just a forlorn hope?
The United States never got back the... You say that Rockefeller and the gang didn't have that much. They had an awful lot of assets. They got cheap in the States. And the people of the United States never got those assets back either.
Scott, what do you reckon make of the Magnitsky Act?
Well, let's not forget that Browder took $400,000 of money from Russia. I think it was $400,000, $400 million, I can't recall, and gave it to Hillary Clinton and the Clinton campaign. And President Putin disclosed that at the Helsinki summit when he stood next to Donald Trump. He said, "We are happy to have the Department of Justice investigators come to Russia and look at the $400,000 or million that was taken out by Browder and given to Hillary Clinton." That's Russian meddling in the election, and it wasn't done by the Russian intelligence services or Putin. It was done by Bill Browder for Hillary Clinton.
Okay, let's just clear that up. Sorry, Scott, just to clear that up, it's $400 million donation to Clinton.
Thank you. $400 million was taken out of Russia and given to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was responsible for the Uranium One deal, where she was selling off uranium assets to Russia. I know personally, because I was in the military and did this for a living, that she was also responsible for Swiss Bank, Union Bank of Switzerland, and Saudi Arabia, and Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer and the Obama administration to funnel hundreds of millions of dollars to the coup d'etat operations in Libya, Ukraine, and Syria. Brad Birkenfeld was the whistleblower. They imprisoned him for it, and WikiLeaks provided evidence from State Department cables that prove Hillary Clinton was involved with this massive financing of terrorism.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Scott, I'm afraid. We're just about coming up to the end of the top of the hour. I want you, Kevin, to tell us a little bit about martial law, because this has been threatened this week, hasn't it, here in Britain, over Brexit.
Yeah, Scott will like this. I actually enforced martial law in the Yemen about 50 years ago. So I'm one of the very few people with experience of what happens. And can I make it really simple? The army get the power to go out in the street, grab you by the neck and shoot you. And yeah. It's crazy. This country got through two world wars and the Northern Ireland crisis without ever bringing in martial law. Martial law is disastrous. It's a lot of people get killed. And this is absurd.
Scott, can you just give us a link to some of your stuff on the internet, please, so people can find you if they want to?
Go to shellgamewhistleblower.com.
That'll do. And your next book, Kevin?
Is Who Owns Ireland?
Okay, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 o'clock now. Coming up live on Facebook, Mohammed McCarvey, we hope. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.